way through Brussels. A German governor-general took possession. The German flag was raised on the town hall. The clocks were put on German time, and an indemnity of 50 million francs, $10 million, payable within 10 days, was imposed upon the capital, and 450 million francs, $90 million, upon the province of Brabant. In Berlin, upon news of the fall of Brussels, bells rang out, shouts of pride and gladness were heard in the streets. The people were frantic with delight, strangers embraced, and a fierce joy reigned. France, on August 20, was not to be deterred from her offensive. Lanrezac had reached the Sambre, and the British were on a level with him. Sir John French, after all his seesawing, now assured Joffre he would be ready to go into action next day. But there was bad news from Lorraine. Ruprecht's counteroffensive had begun with tremendous impact. Castelnau's Second Army, unbalanced by the loss of the corps which Joffre had transferred to the Belgian front, was retreating, and Dubai reported being severely attacked. In Alsace, against greatly reduced German forces, General Pau had retaken Mulhouse and all the surrounding region, but now that Lanrezac's move to the Sambre had pulled away strength from the central offensive, Pau's troops were needed to take their place in the line. In Joffre's sore need, the decision was taken to withdraw Pau's forces. Even Alsace, the greatest sacrifice, was to be laid on the altar of Plan 17. Although, like the iron mines of Brie, Alsace was expected to be regained with victory, General Pau's despair speaks through the lines of his last proclamation to the people he had just liberated. In the north, the great battle begins which will decide the fate of France and with it that of Alsace. It is there that the commander-in-chief summons all the forces of the nation for the decisive attack. For us, in deep chagrin, it becomes necessary to leave Alsace momentarily to assure her final deliverance. It is a cruel necessity to which the army of Alsace and its commander have had pain in submitting, and to which they would never have submitted except in the last extremity. Afterward, all that remained in French hands was a tiny wedge of territory around Tarn, where Joffre came in November and said simply, bringing tears to a silent crowd, "Je vous apporte le baiser de la France." I bring you a kiss from France. Final deliverance of the rest of Alsace was to wait 4 long years. On the Sambre, where Lanrezac was to take the offensive next day, the 20th was an exciting day for the troops, in the words of Lieutenant Spears. There was crisis in the air. Not a man but felt that a great battle was at hand. The morale of the 5th Army was extremely high. They felt certain of success. Their commander was less so. General Damade, commander of the group of 3 territorial divisions, which Joffre, as a last-minute gesture, had sent around to the left of the British, was also disquieted. In answer to a query he addressed to GQG, General Berthelot replied, "Reports on German forces in Belgium are greatly exaggerated. There is no reason to get excited. The dispositions taken at my orders are sufficient for the moment." At 3 o'clock that afternoon, General de Langle de Carry of the 4th Army reported enemy movements across his front and asked Joffre if he should not begin the offensive at once. At GQG, the conviction reigned firmly that the greater the movement to the German right, the thinner its centre. "I understand your impatience," Joffre replied, "but in my opinion the time to attack is not yet. The more the region of the Ardennes is depleted at the moment we pass to the offensive, the better the results to be anticipated from the advance of the 4th Army supported by the 3rd. It is therefore of the utmost importance that we allow the enemy to flow by us to the northwest without attacking him prematurely." At 9 that night, he judged the time had come and issued the order to the 4th Army to begin the offensive at once. It was the hour of élan. "To Messimy," Joffre reported as night fell on August 20, "there is reason to await with confidence the development of operations." Chapter 14. Debacle. Lorraine, Ardennes, Charleroi, Mons. "It is a glorious and awful thought," wrote Henry Wilson in his diary on August 21, "that before the week is over, the greatest action the world has ever heard of will have been fought." As he wrote, the action had already begun. From August 20 to 24, the whole of the Western Front blazed with battle. In reality, four battles, known to history collectively as the Battle of the Frontiers. Beginning on the right in Lorraine, where the fighting had been in progress since August 14, results were communicated all along the frontier, so that the issue in Lorraine had effect on Ardennes, and Ardennes on Sambre and Meuse, known as the Battle of Charleroi, and Charleroi on Mons. By morning of August 20 in Lorraine, the First Army of General Dubois and the Second Army of General de Castelnau had battered themselves to bruised and bloody punishment against the prepared defences of the Germans at Sarrebourg and Morhange. Offensive à outrance found its limit too soon against the heavy artillery, barbed wire and entrenched machine guns of the defence. In prescribing the tactics of assault, French field regulations had calculated that in a dash of 20 seconds, the infantry line could cover 50 metres before the enemy infantry would have time to shoulder guns, take aim and fire. All these gymnastics, so painfully practised at manoeuvres, as a French soldier said bitterly afterward, proved grim folly on the battlefield. With machine guns, the enemy needed only 8 seconds to fire, not 20. The field regulations had also calculated that shrapnel fired by the 75s would neutralise the defensive by forcing the enemy to keep his head down and fire into the blue. Instead, as Ian Hamilton had warned from the Russo-Japanese War, an enemy under shrapnel fire, if entrenched behind parapets, could continue to fire through loopholes straight at the attacker. Despite setbacks, both French generals ordered an advance for August 20. Unsupported by artillery barrage, their troops threw themselves against the German fortified line. Ruprecht's counterattack, which OHL had not had the nerve to deny him, opened the same morning with murderous artillery fire that tore gaping holes in the French ranks. Foch's 20th Corps of Castelnau's army formed the spearhead of the attack. The advance faltered before the defences of Morhange. The Bavarians, whose ardour Ruprecht had been so loath to repress, attacked in their turn, plunged forward into French territory, where as soon as someone raised the cry of franc-tireur, they engaged in a frenzy of looting, shooting and burning. In the ancient town of Nomony, in the valley of the Moselle between Metz and Nancy, 50 civilians were shot or bayoneted on August 20, and what remained of its houses, after half had been shattered by artillery, were burned by order of Colonel von Hunnepel of the 8th Bavarian Regiment. Heavily engaged along its entire front, Castelnau's army was now strongly attacked on its left flank by a German detachment from the garrison of Metz. With his left giving way and all his reserves already thrown in, Castelnau realised all hope of advance was gone and broke off battle. Defensive, the forbidden word, the forbidden idea, had to be recognised as the only choice. Whether he recognised, as Plan 17's most passionate critic suggests he should have, that the duty of the French army was not to attack but to defend French soil is doubtful. He ordered a general retreat to the defensive line of the Grand Couronne because he had to. On his right, Dubois' First Army, in spite of severe casualties, was holding its ground and had even made an advance. When its right flank was uncovered by Castelnau's retreat, Joffre ordered the First Army to retire in conformity with its neighbour. Dubois' repugnance at having to give up territory taken after 7 days of battle was strong, and his old antipathy to Castelnau was not softened by a withdrawal which he felt the position of my army in no way required. Although the French did not yet know it, the slaughter at Morhange snuffed out the bright flame of the doctrine of the offensive. It died on a field in Lorraine, where at the end of the day nothing was visible but corpses strewn in rows and sprawled in the awkward attitudes of sudden death, as if the place had been swept by a malignant hurricane. It was one of those lessons, a survivor realised afterward, by which God teaches the law to kings. The power of the defence that was to transform the initial war of movement into a 4-year war of position and eat up a generation of European lives revealed itself at Morhange. Foch, the spiritual father of Plan 17, the man who taught, "There is only one way of defending ourselves, to attack as soon as we are ready," was there to see and experience it. For 4 more years of relentless, merciless, useless killing, the belligerents beat their heads against it. In the end, it was Foch who presided over victory. By then, the lesson learned proved wrong for the next war. On August 21, General de Castelnau heard that his son had been killed in the battle. To his staff, who tried to express their sympathy, he said, after a moment's silence, in a phrase that was to become something of a slogan for France, "We will continue, gentlemen." Next day, the thunder of Ruprecht's heavy artillery, like the hoofs of an approaching stampede, sounded ceaselessly. 4,000 shells fell on Saint-Geneviève near Nomeny in a bombardment lasting 75 hours. Castelnau believed the situation so serious as possibly to require retreat behind the Grand Couronnet, yielding Nancy. "I went to Nancy on the 21st, Foch wrote afterward. "They wanted to evacuate it. I said, the enemy is 5 days from Nancy, and the 20th Corps is there. They won't walk over the 20th without protest." Now the metaphysics of the lecture hall became the attaque of the battlefield. Foch argued that with the fortified line at their backs, the best defense was counterattack, and won his point. On August 22, he saw an opportunity. Between the French fortified zones of Toul and Épinal, there was a natural gap called the Trouée de Charme, where the French had expected to canalize the German attack. Reconnaissance showed that Ruprecht, by taking the offensive toward Charme, was exposing his flank to the army of Nancy. Ruprecht's movement had been decided in another of the fateful telephone conversations with OHL. The success of the German left-wing armies in throwing back the French from Sarrebourg and Morhange had 2 results. It brought Ruprecht the Iron Cross, first and second class, a relatively harmless result, and it revived OHL's vision of a decisive battle in Lorraine. Perhaps, after all, frontal attack could be mastered by German might. Perhaps Épinal and Toul would prove as vulnerable as Liège, and the Moselle no more a barrier than the Meuse. Perhaps, after all, the 2 armies of the left wing could succeed in breaking through the French fortified line, and in cooperation with the right wing, bring about a true canny, a double envelopment. As reported by Colonel Tappan, this was the prospect that shone before the eyes of OHL. Like the smile of a temptress, it overcame years of single, wedded devotion to the right wing. While the idea was being breathlessly discussed by Moltke and his advisers, a call came through from General Kraft von Dell-Mensingen, Ruprecht's chief of staff, who wanted to know whether the attack was to continue or come to a halt. It had always been assumed that once Ruprecht's armies contained the initial French offensive and stabilized their front, they would halt, organize their defenses, and free all available forces to reinforce the right wing. An alternative known as Case 3, however, had been carefully provided, which allowed for an attack across the Moselle, but only at the express order of OHL. "We must definitely know how the operation is to continue," Kraft demanded. "I assume Case 3 is in order." "No, no," replied Colonel Tappan, the chief of operations. "Moltke hasn't decided yet. If you hold the line for 5 minutes, I may be able to give you the orders you want." In less than 5 minutes, he returned with a surprising answer. "Pursue direction Épinal." Kraft was stunned. "In those few minutes, I felt that one of the most consequential decisions of the war had been made." Pursue direction Épinal meant offensive through the Trouée de Charme. It meant committing the 6th and 7th armies to frontal attack upon the French fortress line, instead of keeping them available for reinforcement of the right wing. Ruprecht duly attacked with vigor next day, August 23rd. Foch counterattacked. In the days that followed, the German 6th and 7th armies locked themselves in combat against the French 1st and 2nd armies, backed by the guns of Belfort, Épinal, and Toul. While they strained, other battles were being fought. Failure of the offensive in Lorraine did not daunt Joffre. Rather, he saw in Ruprecht's violent counterattack, deeply engaging the German left wing, the right moment to unleash his own offensive against the German centre. It was after learning of Castelnau's retreat from Morhange that Joffre, on the night of August 20, gave the signal for attack in the Ardennes, the central and basic maneuver of Plan 17. At the same time as the 4th and 3rd armies entered the Ardennes, he ordered the 5th Army to take the offensive across the Sambre against the enemy's northern group, GQG's term for the German right wing. He gave the order, though he'd just learned from Colonel Adelbert and Sir John French, that support for this offensive from the Belgians and the British would not be forthcoming as expected. The Belgian army, except for one division at Namur, had broken off contact, and the British army, according to its commander, would not be ready for 3 or 4 days. Besides this change in circumstances, the battle in Lorraine had revealed dangerous errors in fighting performance. These had been recognized as early as August 16, when Joffre issued instructions to all army commanders on the necessity of learning to await artillery support and of preventing the troops from hastily exposing themselves to the enemy's fire. Nevertheless, France was committed to Plan 17 as her only design for decisive victory, and Plan 17 demanded the offensive now and no later. The only alternative would have been to change at once to defence of the frontiers. In terms of the training, the planning, the thinking, the spirit of the French military organism, this was unthinkable. Moreover, GQG was convinced that the French armies would have numerical superiority in the centre. The French staff could not release itself from the grip of the theory that had dominated all its planning, that the Germans were bound to be thinned out in the centre. In that belief, Joffre gave the order for the general offensive in the Ardennes and on the Sambre for August 21. The terrain of the Ardennes is not suitable for the offensive. It is wooded, hilly and irregular, with the slope running generally uphill from the French side and with the declivities between the hills cut by many streams. Caesar, who took 10 days to march across it, described the secret dark forest as a place full of terrors, with muddy paths and a perpetual mist rising from the peat bogs. Much of it had since been cleared and cultivated. Roads, villages, and 2 or 3 large towns had replaced Caesar's terrors, but large sections were still covered with thick leafy woods where roads were few and ambush easy. French staff officers had examined the terrain on several tours before 1914 and knew its difficulties. In spite of their warnings, the Ardennes was chosen as the place of breakthrough, because here, at the centre, German strength was expected to be least. The French had persuaded themselves of the feasibility of the ground, on the theory that its very difficulty made it, as Joffre said, rather favourable to the side which, like ourselves, had inferiority of heavy artillery but superiority of field guns. Joffre's memoirs, despite constant use of the pronoun I, were compiled and written by a staff of military collaborators and represent a careful and virtually official version of the dominant thinking of the general staff before and during 1914. On August 20, GQG, assuming the reported enemy movements across the front to be German units heading for the Meuse, envisaged the Ardennes as relatively depleted of the enemy. As Joffre intended to make his attack a surprise, he forbade infantry reconnaissance, which might make contact and cause skirmishes with the enemy before the main encounter. Surprise was indeed achieved, but the French took their share of it. The bottom corner of the Ardennes meets France at the upper corner of Lorraine, where the Brilly iron region is located. The area had been occupied by the Prussian army in 1870. The ore of Brie not having then been discovered, the region had not been included in that part of Lorraine annexed by Germany. The centre of the iron region was L'Aunouy, on the banks of the Cher, and the honour of taking L'Aunouy had been reserved for the Crown Prince, commander of the German Fifth Army. At 32, the Imperial Scion was a narrow-chested, willowy creature with the face of a fox, who did not at all resemble his 5 sturdy brothers, whom the Empress at annual intervals had presented to her husband. William, the Crown Prince, gave an impression of physical frailty, and in the words of an American observer, only ordinary mental calibre, unlike his father. Like him a poseur, fond of striking attitudes, he suffered from the compulsory filial antagonism usual to the eldest sons of kings, and expressed it in the usual manner, political rivalry, and private dissipation. He had made himself the patron and partisan of the most aggressive militarist opinion, and his photograph was sold in the Berlin shops carrying the inscription, "Only by relying on the sword can we gain the place in the sun that is our due, but that is not voluntarily accorded to us." Despite an upbringing intended to prepare him for military command, his training had not quite reached the adequate. It included colonelcy of the Death's Head Hussars and a year's service on the general staff, but had not included either a divisional or corps command. Nevertheless, the Crown Prince felt that his experience with the staff and on staff rides in the last few years gave me the theoretical grounding for command of large units. His confidence would not have been shared by Schlieffen, who deplored the appointment of young, inexperienced commanders. He feared they would be more interested to go dashing off on a wilde Jagd nach dem Pulle Merite, a wild hunt after the highest honour, than to follow the strategic plan. The role of the Crown Prince's Fifth Army, together with the Fourth Army under the Duke of Württemberg, was to be the pivot of the right wing, moving slowly forward at the centre as the right wing swung out and down in its great enveloping sweep. The Fourth Army was to advance through the Northern Ardennes against Neufchâteau, while the Fifth Army advanced through the Southern Ardennes against Virton and the two French fortress towns Longwy and Montmédy. The Crown Prince's headquarters were at Thionville, called Diedenhofen by the Germans, where he dined on a manly soldier's fare of cabbage soup, potatoes and boiled beef with horseradish, eked out, as concession to a prince, by wild duck, salad, fruit, wine, coffee and cigars. Surrounded by the grave and gloomy faces of the native population, and envying the glory won at Liège and the progress of the right wing, the Crown Prince and his staff waited feverishly for action. At last, marching orders came for August 19. Opposite the Crown Prince's army was the French Third Army under General Ruffy. A lone apostle of heavy artillery, Ruffy was known, because of his eloquence on behalf of the big guns, as le poète du canon. He had dared not only to question the omnipotence of the 75s, but also to propose the use of airplanes as an offensive arm and the creation of an air force of 3,000 planes. The idea was not admired. "Tout ça, c'est du sport," exclaimed General Foch in 1910. "That's just games." For use by the army, he had added, "L'avion, c'est zéro. The aeroplane is worthless." Next year at manoeuvres, General Gallieni, by using airplane reconnaissance, captured a colonel of the Supreme War Council with all his staff. By 1914, the French army was using airplanes, but General Ruffy was still regarded as having too much imagination. Besides, as he showed a disinclination to allow staff officers to tell him what to do, he had made enemies at GQG before he ever entered the Ardennes. His headquarters were at Verdun, and his task was to throw the enemy back on Metz-Thionville and invest them there, retaking the Brie region in the course of his advance. While he folded back the enemy on the right of the German centre, his neighbour, the Fourth Army under General de Langle de Carrie, would fold them back on the left. The two French armies would cleave their way through the middle and lop off the arm of the German right wing at the shoulder. General de Langle, a veteran of 1870, had been retained in command, despite his having reached the French age limit of 64 a month before the war. In appearance a sharp, alert bantam, alive with energy, he resembled Foch, and like him always looked in photographs as if about to leap into action. General de Langle was ready, indeed aching, to leap now, and refused to be discouraged by disquieting news. His cavalry, in combat near Neufchâteau, had run into heavy opposition and had been forced to retire. A reconnaissance tour by a staff officer in an automobile had brought further warning. The officer had talked at Arlon to a worried official of the Luxembourg government, who said the Germans were in the nearby forests in strength. On the way back, the officer's car was fired on, but his reports to Fourth Army headquarters were judged pessimistic. The mood was one of valour, not discretion. The moment had come to move fast, not hesitate. It was only after the battle that General de Langle remembered that he had disapproved of Joffre's order to attack without allowing me to take soundings first. Only afterwards that he wrote, GQG wanted surprise, but it was we who were surprised. General Ruffy was more troubled than his neighbour. He took more seriously the reports brought in by Belgian peasants of Germans lodged among the woods and cornfields. When he told GQG his estimate of enemy strength opposing him, they paid no attention to him and did not, or so he was to claim, even read his reports. Fog was thick from the ground up everywhere in the Ardennes on the morning of August 21. The German 4th and 5th armies had been moving forward on the 19th and 20th, entrenching their positions as they advanced. A French attack was expected, although they did not know when or where. In the dense fog, the French cavalry patrols sent ahead to scout the ground might as well have been blindfolded. The opposing armies, moving forward through the woods and between the hills, unable to see ahead more than a few paces, stumbled into each other before they knew what was in front of them. As soon as the first units established contact, and commanders became aware that battle was erupting all around them, the Germans dug in. The French, whose officers in pre-war training disdained to give the troops entrenching practice for fear of making them sticky, and who carried as few picks and shovels as possible, threw themselves into attaque brusque with the bayonet. They were mown down by machine guns. In some encounters, the French 75s slaughtered German units, who had likewise been taken by surprise. On the first day, the encounters were scattered and preliminary. On the 22nd, the Lower Ardennes was engulfed in full-scale battle. In separate combats at Virton and Tintigny and Rossignol and Neufchâteau, guns roared and flared, men flung themselves at each other, the wounded fell and the dead piled up. At Rossignol, Algerians of the French 3rd Colonial Division were surrounded by the 6th Corps of the Crown Prince's army and fought for 6 hours until the survivors were but a remnant. Their divisional commander, General Raffanel, and a brigade commander, General Rondonnet, were both killed. In August 1914, general officers were casualties like ordinary soldiers. At Virton, the French 6th Corps, under General Sarray, took a German corps in the flank with fire from its 75s. "The battlefield afterwards was an unbelievable spectacle," reported a French officer, dazed with horror. "Thousands of dead were still standing, supported as if by a flying buttress made of bodies, lying in rows on top of each other in an ascending arc from the horizontal to an angle of 60 degrees. Officers from Saint-Cyr went into battle wearing white-plumed shakos and white gloves. It was considered chic to die in white gloves. An unidentified French sergeant kept a diary. "The guns recoil at each shot. Night is falling and they look like old men sticking out their tongues and spitting fire. Heaps of corpses, French and German, are lying every which way, rifles in hand. Rain is falling, shells are screaming and bursting, shells all the time. Artillery fire is the worst. I lay all night listening to the wounded groaning. Some were Germans. The cannonading goes on. Whenever it stops, we hear the wounded crying from all over the woods. 2 or 3 men go mad every day." At Tintigny, a German officer also kept a diary. "Nothing more terrible could be imagined," he wrote. "We advanced much too fast. A civilian fired at us. He was immediately shot. We were ordered to attack the enemy flank in a forest of beeches. We lost our direction. The men were done for. The enemy opened fire. Shells came down on us like hail." The Crown Prince, not to be outdone by Ruprecht, whose victories at Sarrebourg and Morhange were now known, urged his forces to match the prodigies of valour and sacrifice of their comrades. He had moved his headquarters to Esch in Luxembourg, just across the river from L'Ennui, and followed the battle on huge maps pinned to the walls. The suspense was torture. Telephone communications with Koblenz were awful. OHL was much too far back. The struggle was frightful, the losses terrible. "L'Ennui is not yet taken," he said, "but we feel we have checked the enemy's offensive." French units were reported retreating in disorder, not in planned retreat. This was so. At the last moment before the battle, General Ruffy was enraged to discover that three reserve divisions, altogether about 50,000 men, which formed part of his army, were no longer part of it. Joffre had sequestered them in response to the threat of Ruprecht's offensive to form a special army of Lorraine made up of these three divisions and four reserve divisions, which he collected elsewhere. The army of Lorraine, under General Monory, began to take form on August 21, between Verdun and Nancy, to back up Castelnau's army and protect the right flank of the advance through the Ardennes. It was one of the last-minute rearrangements which proved the saving flexibility of the French army, but at the moment had a negative result. It cut into Ruffet's strength and kept seven divisions immobile at a vital time. Ruffet always claimed afterward that if he had had the extra 50,000 men to whom he had already issued orders, he could have won the Battle of Virton. At the time, his anger proved too much for tact. When a staff officer from GQG came to his headquarters during the battle, Ruffet exploded, "You people at GQG never read the reports we send you. You are as ignorant as an oyster of all that the enemy has in his bag. Tell the Generalissimo his operations are worse than 1870. He sees absolutely nothing. Incapacity everywhere." This was not a message to be welcomed upon Olympus, where Joffre and his attendant deities were more inclined to lay the blame on the incapacity of commanders and troops, Ruffet among them. On the same day, August 22, General de Langle was experiencing a commander's most agonizing moments, waiting for news from the front. Chaining himself in anguish to his headquarters at Stenay on the Meuse, 20 miles from Sedan, he received bad reports coming hard upon each other. The instinct to rush to the scene of combat could only be checked by reminding himself that a general must not lose himself among his units, but can only direct their movements at a distance. To maintain sang-froid before his staff, and that mastery of himself indispensable to achieve at critical moments, was as difficult. As the day ended, the terrible casualties of the Colonial Corps became known. Another corps, through mishandling by its commander, as de Langle believed, was in retreat, endangering its neighbours. "Serious check at Tantigny. All troops engaged with unsatisfactory results," he had to report to Joffre, adding that losses and disorganisation of his units made it impossible to carry out his orders for August 23. Joffre simply refused to believe it. With serene complacence, he reported to Messimy, even after receiving de Langle's report, that the armies had been placed where the enemy is most vulnerable and so as to assure ourselves of numerical superiority. GQG's work was done. Now it was up to the troops and their commanders who have the advantage of that superiority. He repeated the assurance to de Langle, insisting that as he had no more than three enemy corps in front of him, he must resume the offensive. In fact, the French armies in the Ardennes enjoyed no superiority but the reverse. The Crown Prince's army included, besides the three corps which the French had identified, two reserve corps with the same numerals as the active corps, as did the Duke of Württemberg's army. Together they massed a greater number of men and guns than the French third and fourth armies. Fighting continued during August 23, but by the end of the day it was known that the French arrow had broken against its target. The enemy had not been vulnerable in the Ardennes after all. Despite the massive strength of his right wing, his centre had not been weak. The French had not cut them in half. With the cry of "En avant!" forward, with waving sword, with all the ardour on which the French army prided itself, officers led their companies to the attack against an enemy who dug in and used his field guns. Field Grey, merging into the fog and shadows, had beaten the two visible Pantalon Rouge. Steady, solid, methodical training had beaten Caen. Both French armies in the Ardennes were in retreat, the third falling back on Verdun and the fourth on Stenay and Sedan. Brie's iron ore was not regained, and for four more years would serve to forge German munitions for the long war which, without that iron, Germany could not have fought. As yet, on the evening of August 23, Joffre did not realize the full extent of the defeat in the Ardennes. "The offensive had been momentarily checked," he telegraphed to Messimy, "but I will make every effort to renew the offensive." The Crown Prince's army on that day passed Longwy, leaving its fortress to be taken by siege troops, and was advancing with orders to head off the French Third Army from Verdun. The prince, who less than a month ago had been cautioned by his father to obey his chief of staff in everything and do as he tells you, was deeply moved on this day of triumph to receive a telegram from Papa William, awarding him, like Ruprecht, the Iron Cross first and second class. The telegram was handed around among the staff, to be read by all. Soon the prince would be handing out medals himself, in a dazzling white tunic, as an admirer describes him later in the war, walking between two lines of soldiers distributing iron crosses from a basket carried by an aide. By that time, an Austrian ally would report, the Iron Cross second class could only be avoided by committing suicide. Today the hero of Longwy, as he was soon to be acclaimed, had won glory equal to Ruprecht's. And if, amid the adulation, the ghost of Schlieffen grumbled at ordinary frontal victories without envelopment or annihilation, or muttered scornful references to a wild hunt for medals, no one heard him. Meanwhile, on the Sambre, Lanrezac's Fifth Army had been ordered to attack across the river, and, resting on the fortress of Namur, with its left passing by Charleroi, was to take as its objective the enemy northern group. One corps of the Fifth Army was to be held in the angle of the rivers to protect the line of the Meuse against a German attack from the east. Although Joffre had no authority to command the British, his order requested Sir John French to cooperate in this action by advancing in the general direction of Soignies, that is, across the Mons Canal. The canal is an extension of the Sambre, which carries navigation to the channel by way of the Scheldt. It formed part of a continuous waterway, made by the Sambre from Namur to Charleroi, and by the canal from Charleroi to the Scheldt, which lay across the path of the German right wing. According to the German timetable, von Kluck's army was to reach the water barrier by August 23, while Bülow's army, which would have to reduce Namur on the way, would reach it earlier and be across it at about the same time. According to the British timetable laid down by Sir John French's marching orders, the BEF would also reach the canal on the 23rd, the same day as the Germans. Neither army was yet aware of the coincidence. The heads of the British columns were scheduled to reach the line earlier, that is, by the night of the 22nd. On the 21st, the day Lanrezac was ordered to cross the Sambre, the BEF, which had been expected to cooperate in the action, was a full day's march behind the French. Instead of fighting together as planned, the two armies, because of the late British start and poor liaison resulting from the unhappy relations of their commanders, were to fight two separate battles, Charleroi and Mons, while their headquarters were only 35 miles apart. In General Lanrezac's heart, the doctrine of the offensive was already dead. He could not see the whole picture, so clear now, of three German armies converging upon his front, but he could feel their presence. Hausen's Third Army was coming at him from the east, Bülow's Second Army from the north, and Kluck's First Army was advancing against the half-sized British army on his left. He did not know their names or numbers, but he knew they were there. He knew, or deduced from reconnaissance, that greater numbers were coming at him than he could dispose of. Evaluation of enemy strength is not an absolute, but a matter of piecing together scraps of reconnaissance and intelligence to form a picture, if possible a picture to fit preconceived theories, or to suit the demands of a particular strategy. What a staff makes out of the available evidence depends upon the degree of optimism or pessimism prevailing among them, on what they want to believe or fear to believe, and sometimes upon the sensitivity or intuition of an individual. To Lanrezac and to GQG, the same reports of German strength west of the Meuse conveyed different pictures. GQG saw a weak German centre in the Ardennes. Lanrezac saw a great wave rolling down with the Fifth Army directly in its path. GQG estimated German strength west of the Meuse at 17 or 18 divisions. Opposed, they counted Lanrezac's 13 divisions, a separate group of two reserve divisions, five British divisions, and one Belgian division at Namur, a total of 21, giving what they believed a comfortable superiority in numbers. Joffre's plan was for this force to hold the Germans behind the Sambre until the French 3rd and 4th armies should break through the German centre in the Ardennes, and then for all together to advance northward and throw the Germans out of Belgium. The British staff, dominated, in fact, if not in rank, by Henry Wilson, agreed with GQG's estimate. In his diary for August 20, Wilson put down the same figure of 17 or 18 divisions for the Germans west of the Meuse, and happily concluded, "The more the better, as it will weaken their centre." Back in England, far from the front, Lord Kitchener felt anxiety and foreboding. On August 19, he telegraphed Sir John French that the German sweep north and west of the Meuse, about which he had warned him, seems definitely to be developing. He asked to be kept informed of all reports, and next day repeated the request. In truth, at that moment, German strength west of the Meuse was not 17 or 18 divisions, but 30, 7 active and 5 reserve corps, 5 cavalry divisions, and other units. Von Hausen's army, which at this time had not yet crossed the Meuse, but which formed part of the right wing, was to add another 4 corps or 8 divisions. While for the Battle of the Frontiers as a whole, German numerical superiority was 1.5 to 1, the right wing's preponderance was nearer 2 to 1. The focus of this force was Lauhersack's army, and he knew it. He believed the British, after his disastrous interview with their commander, to be both unready and unreliable. He knew the Belgian defence to be cracking at Namur. One of the new corps assigned to him in the recent exchange of units, which was to hold his left flank west of Charleroi, had not yet come into position on August 21. If he attacked across the Sambre as ordered, he believed he would be outflanked by the German forces pouring down on his left, who would then have nothing between them and Paris. The guiding principle of all that he had ever taught at Saint-Cyr and the École Supérieure, the principle that trained the French army, was to attack the enemy wherever met. He looked at it now and saw the face of a skeleton. Lauhersack hesitated. He wrote to Joffre that if he took the offensive north of the Sambre, the Fifth Army may be exposed to giving battle alone, as the British would not be ready to act in liaison with him. If both were to act in unison, the Fifth Army must wait until the 23rd or 24th. Joffre replied, "I leave you absolute judge of the moment to begin your offensive." The enemy was not so permissive. Detachments of Bülow's army, whose main force was already attacking Namur, plunged down upon the Sambre on August 21 and forced crossings at 2 points between Namur and Charleroi. Troops of the Fifth Army had been told by Lauhersack that their own offensive waited upon neighbouring armies, and that in the meantime they were to oppose any German attempts to cross the river. Defensive preparations not being in the French military vocabulary, the 10th Corps, which held this sector, had not dug in or laid wire or otherwise organized the defenses of the South Bank, but waited to hurl themselves bodily upon the enemy. With bugles blowing, drums beating and flags flying, but without artillery preparation, the French now dashed to the assault. After sharp combat, they were driven back, and by nightfall the enemy remained in possession of Tamines and another village on the south side of the river. Over the crack of musketry and crash of shells, a deeper sound like that of a gigantic drum could be heard in the distance. The German siege guns had begun the bombardment of the forts of Namur. Dragged down from Liège, the 420s and 305s had been brought within range, cemented into emplacements, and were now pouring their 2-ton shells on a second Belgian fortress. The shells came over with a long singing scream, wrote an Englishwoman who had led a volunteer ambulance corps to Namur. They seemed to be coming directly at the listener wherever he stood, and to explode within a yard of him wherever they hit. The town cowered through 2 days of the terrible sound as destruction thundered out of the sky upon the forts around them. The same effects as at Liège, of explosive gases, of concrete crumbled like plaster, of men in the underground chambers driven mad, were repeated. Cut off from the rest of the Belgian army, the garrison troops and the 4th Division felt themselves deserted. Commander Durguy, Lauhersack's liaison officer at Namur, returned to Fifth Army headquarters to say he did not think the forts would hold out another day without some evidence of French help. They must see the French troops marching along with colours unfurled and a band playing. There must be a band, he pleaded. Three French battalions, one regiment of some 3,000 men, were sent off that night and joined the defence of Namur next morning. The defence numbered 37,000. The German force engaged in the assault from August 21 to 24 ranged from 107,000 to 153,000, with 400 to 500 pieces of artillery. On the night of August 21, Sir John French reported to Kitchener that he did not think there would be serious fighting before the 24th. "I think I know the situation thoroughly, and I regard it as favourable to us," he wrote. He did not know it as thoroughly as he thought. Next day, as British troops were marching up the road to Mons in the general direction of Soigny, cavalry patrols reported a German corps marching down the Brussels-Mons road, also making for Soigny. From their position, they could be expected to reach the village that night. It seemed unlikely the enemy would wait for Sir John's target date of the 24th. More alarming news was brought by a British aviator, who reported another German corps marching down a road far enough to the west to outflank the British left. Envelopment. Suddenly, in startling clarity, the menace loomed before British eyes, at least before the eyes of the intelligence section. The sweep, Kitchener eternally talked of, was no longer an idea, but columns of living men. The staff commanders, under Henry Wilson's influence, discounted it. Wedded, through Wilson, to French strategy, they were no more inclined than GQG to accept an alarmist view of the German right wing. "The information you have acquired and conveyed to the commander-in-chief appears to be somewhat exaggerated," they decided, and left marching orders unchanged. They were conscious of treading on territory of past triumphs. 10 miles south of Mons, they passed through Malplaquet on the border between France and Belgium, and saw by the roadside the stone monument marking the spot where Marlborough had defeated the armies of Louis XIV and won immortality in a French folk song. Ahead of them, between Mons and Brussels, lay Waterloo. Returning to that victorious field almost on the 100th anniversary of the battle, they could not but feel confident. As the heads of their columns neared Mons on the 22nd, part of a cavalry squadron scouting the road north of the canal saw a group of four horsemen riding toward them. They looked unfamiliar. At the same instant, the strange riders saw the British and halted. There was a kind of breathless pause before each realized he was looking at the enemy. The Uhlans turned to rejoin the rest of their squadron and galloped back, chased by the British, who caught up with them in the streets of Soigny. In a sharp skirmish, the Uhlans were hampered by their long lances, and a good many threw them away. The British killed three or four and left the somewhat restricted field victorious. Captain Hornby, leader of the squadron, was awarded the DSO as the first British officer to kill a German with the new pattern cavalry sword. The war had opened in correct style with the most encouraging results. First contact having been made on the road to Soigny, as expected, the staff commanders were given no cause to change their estimate of the enemy's strength or position. German strength opposing the British was put by Wilson at one or possibly two corps and one cavalry division, which was inferior or at most equal to the BEF's two corps and a cavalry division. Wilson's forceful character, high spirits, and recognized familiarity with the ground and with the French carried greater persuasion than the reports of intelligence officers, especially as operations officers traditionally discount estimates by their brother bureau on the theory that intelligence always assumes the worst. The death of Sir James Grierson, who among the British had been the closest student of German military theory and practice, gave Wilson's theories, which were a duplicate of GQG's, that much greater sway. Battle on the morrow was expected with confidence by the staff and corps commanders, if not by Sir John French. His mood was still murky, his hesitancy almost a replica of Larezac's. When General Smith Dorrien, just arrived in France to replace Grierson, came up on the 21st, he was told to give battle on the line of the Condé Canal. When Smith Dorrien asked if this meant offensive or defensive, he was told to obey orders. One factor worrying Sir John French was ignorance of Lanrezac's plan of battle on his right flank and fear of a gap opening between them. He set off in a motor car on the morning of the 22nd to confer with his unpleasing neighbour, but on being told en route that Lanrezac had gone forward to Corps headquarters at Metay, where the 10th Corps was now in the heat of combat, he returned without meeting him. One piece of good news met him at headquarters. The 4th Division, left behind in England at the start, had arrived in France and was on its way forward. The lengthening shadow of the German advance through Belgium and the withdrawal of the Belgian army to Antwerp had decided Kitchener to send it over. General von Kluck was more surprised than the British by the cavalry clash on the road at Soigny. Up to this moment, so effective were French and British security measures, he did not know the British were in front of him. He knew they had landed because he had read the news in a Belgian newspaper, which published Kitchener's official communique announcing the safe arrival of the BEF on French soil. This announcement, on August 20, was the first England, the world, and the enemy knew of the landing. Kluck still thought they had landed at Ostend, Dunkirk, and Calais, chiefly because he wanted to think so, his intention being to attack and disperse the British along with the Belgians before meeting the French. Now, as he moved down from Brussels, he had to worry about a Belgian sortie from Antwerp at his rear and a possible pounce upon his flank by the British, mysteriously deploying, so he thought, somewhere in Belgium to his right. He kept trying to edge his army westward in order to find and meet the British, but Bülow, in constant fear of a gap, kept issuing orders pulling him inward. Kluck protested, Bülow insisted. "Otherwise," he said, "the First Army might get too far away and not be able to support the Second Army." On discovering the British squarely in front of him at Soigny, Kluck again attempted a shift to the west in order to find the enemy flank. When again prevented by Bülow, he protested furiously to OHL. OHL's notion of British whereabouts was even dimmer than the Allies' notion of the whereabouts of the German right wing. "It appears from here that no landings of great importance have taken place," said OHL, and rejected Kluck's proposal. Deprived of the opportunity to envelop the enemy and condemned to frontal attack, Kluck moved wrathfully on Mons. His orders for August 23 were to cross the canal, occupy the ground to the south, and force the enemy back into Maubeuge while cutting off his retreat from the west. Bülow, on that day, August 22, was having as much trouble with Hausen on his left as with Kluck on his right. As Kluck's tendency was to get ahead, Hausen's was to lag behind. With advance units of his army already engaged across the Sambre against Lanrezac's 10th Corps, Bülow planned a battle of annihilation in a great joint attack by his own and Hausen's army. But on the 22nd, Hausen was not ready. Bülow complained bitterly of insufficient cooperation from his neighbour. Hausen complained equally bitterly of suffering from Bülow's constant demands for help. Deciding not to wait, Bülow threw three corps into a violent attack upon the line of the Sambre. During that day and the next, Bülow's and Lanrezac's armies grappled each other in the Battle of Charleroi, Hausen's army joining in by the end of the first day. These were the same 2 days when the French 3rd and 4th armies were wrestling with disaster in the fog and forest of the Ardennes. Lanrezac was at Metay to direct the battle, a process which consisted largely of agonized waiting for divisional and corps commanders to report back what was happening to them. They in turn found it hard enough to find out what was happening from units under heavy fire, or gripped in combat in village streets, or stumbling back exhausted and bleeding, with hardly an officer left to make a report. Visual evidence reached Metay before reports. A car carrying a wounded officer drove into the square, where Lanrezac and his staff paced anxiously, too restless to remain indoors. The wounded man was recognized as General Boer, commander of a division of the 10th Corps. With a face the colour of ashes and eyes of tragedy, he whispered slowly and painfully to Elie Doisel, who ran to the car, "Tell him, tell the general, we held on as long as we could." On the left of the 10th Corps, the 3rd Corps, in front of Charleroi, reported terrible losses. The sprawling industrial town lying on both sides of the river, having been penetrated by the Germans during the day, the French were fighting furiously to dislodge them. When the Germans attacked in dense formation, as was their habit before they learned better, they made perfect targets for the 75s. But the 75s, which could fire 15 times a minute, were supplied with shells at a rate sufficiently for only 2.25 shots per minute. At Charleroi, the Turcos of the two Algerian divisions, recruited by voluntary enlistment, fought as valiantly as had their fathers at Sedan. One battalion charged a German gun battery, bayoneting the gunners, and returned with 2 men unwounded out of the battalion's complement of 1,030. Everywhere the French were enraged or demoralized, according to the circumstances in different sectors, by the shelling from batteries they usually could not see or get at. They felt helpless rage at the hawk-shaped German airplanes overhead, which acted as artillery spotters, and whose flight over their lines was invariably followed by a new burst of shells. By evening, Lanrezac had to report the 10th Corps forced to fall back, having suffered severely, the 3rd Corps heavily engaged, heavy casualties in officers, the 18th Corps on the left intact, but General Sordet's cavalry corps on the far left greatly exhausted and also forced to fall back, leaving a gap between the 5th Army and the British. It proved to be a gap of 10 miles, wide enough for an enemy corps. Lanrezac's anxiety was so acute as to move him to send word to Sir John French, asking him to relieve pressure on the French by attacking Bulow's right flank. Sir John replied he could not comply, but promised to hold the line of the Mons Canal for 24 hours. During the night, Lanrezac's position became further imperiled when Hausen brought 4 fresh corps and 340 guns into action on the Meuse. He attacked during the night and gained bridgeheads across the river, which were counterattacked by Franchet-Desperey's 1st Corps, whose mission was to hold the Meuse along the right side of Lanrezac's front. His was the only corps of the 5th Army to entrench its position. Hausen's intention, in compliance with orders from OHL, was to attack southwest towards Givet, where he expected to come in upon the rear of Lanrezac's army, which could then be caught between his and Bulow's forces and destroyed. Bulow, however, whose units in this sector had taken as severe punishment as they had given, was determined to mount a massive and terminal attack, and ordered Hausen to attack directly westward toward Mathé upon the body of the 5th Army, instead of southwestward along its line of retreat. Hausen complied. This was an error. It engaged Hausen all during August 23 in frontal attack against the strongly held positions and vigorous generalship of Franchet-Desperey's corps, and it left Lanrezac's line of retreat open, an opening through which the opportunity for a battle of annihilation was to slip away. Through the hot, clear hours of August 23, the summer sky was spattered with the greasy black puffs of bursting shells. The French had instantly dubbed them marmite, after the cast-iron soup pot that sits on every French stove. Il pleut de marmite, it rained shells, was all that one tired soldier could remember of the day. In some places the French were still attacking, trying to throw the Germans back across the Sambre. In others they were holding, in still others they were retreating in crippled, broken disorder. The roads were choked with long columns of Belgian refugees, coated with dust, weighted down with babies and bundles, pushing wheelbarrows, dully, tiredly, endlessly moving toward no goal or home or refuge, but only away from the awful roar of guns to the north. The refugee columns passed through Philippeville, 20 miles from Charleroi, where Lanrezac had his headquarters that day. Standing in the square, with red-trousered legs apart and hands clasped behind his back, Lanrezac watched them somberly, saying nothing. Above his black tunic, his dark face looked almost pale, and his fleshy cheeks sunken. He felt prey to extreme anxiety. Enemy pressure was bending against him from all sides. No guidance came from GQG except to ask his opinion of the situation. Lanrezac felt acutely conscious of the gap made by the retreat of Sordet's cavalry. At noon came the news, foreseen yet still incredible, that the Belgian 4th Division was evacuating Namur. The city, dominating the confluence of Sambre and Meuse, as well as the forts on the heights behind it, would soon be in Bulow's hands. No word came from General de Langle de Carrie of the 4th Army, to whom Larozac had sent a message that morning asking for a manoeuvre to strengthen the sector where their forces joined. Larozac's staff was urging him to permit a counterattack by Franchet d'Esperey, who reported a glittering opportunity. A German force in pursuit of the retreating 10th Corps was presenting its flank to him. Other ardent pleaders urged a counterattack on the far left by the 18th Corps to relieve pressure on the British, who on this day at Mons were